All right, we're live. Excited to have here Joe Summers from a portfolio of companies to chat about getting to Hell Yes. I'm at TAA right now. Joe is not at TAA, so we're doing this virtual, but we can dig in on that a little bit more in terms of the go-to-market strategy for some of these things and where events are going. That might be an interesting thread to chat on. Everyone here listening, if you're listening today, wonderful to have you today. Certainly, if it's your first-time listener, the conversation with Getting to Hell Yes is about, you know, the change from the modern buyer's perspective and then certainly the buyer's journey and who we serve and how we serve them, how we can find them. And probably the most important thing, or one of the most difficult things to figure out, is how we can begin to connect with that buyer when they're seeking to commit to change. Obviously, Joe, plenty of experience in all sorts of different parts of multifamily, selling to both owners, operator, or managers, owner managers. How is that different? Lots of conversations there. If anyone is listening on the live show, please throw some questions out there. That's always makes it much more engaging. And it's kind of fun to throw some curveballs at it. That's always an interesting part of being a live show. This is brought to you by IRCX. IRCX, we're AI remote maintenance software for the multifamily and the single family business. I'm looking to save trips and triage. If that's bogging you down, certainly give us a call. And let's get started here. Let's get to Hell Yes. So Joe, a little bit about your background. I'm sure everyone, while they may know of you or, you know, have heard of you, a little bit of background, especially where you guys got to today, and you know, some of the problems you solve. We usually ask the problem that you solve, but giving your portfolio companies is a special opportunity to talk about the problems that you solve and what you seek for an opportunity, and then, you know, how you go at something with all the energy that you've got, given the different sort of like opportunities that are out there. Pass it to you, Fred.
I mean, dude, the easiest way to get the yes is to solve a problem, not sell something, right? Like,
well, you think so. Just because it's a problem doesn't make it a priority.
Right? Hence the reason why your podcast exists. Yes. Joe Summers, I've been in the industry since 1999, so 26 years. I'm just going to stop counting that and just say 99, but then I realize that sounds really I've been very fortunate. You know, it's funny. You know, I was also, you know, I'm almost 50. I'll be 50 this year. And I kind of compare when I got into the industry and when I was born. You know, when you're born in the mid 70s, it was a weird time frame. We grew up with nothing. In the 80s, I had the best childhood. I rode my bike 10 miles away from the house and the parents never even knew. And
oh, yeah. We have a lot to share on that topic.
Right. And, you know, now we've transitioned to what it is. So I kind of compare when I was born to when I was born in the industry in 99. And when I got in the industry in 99, technology, and I've said this on other, you know, things I've been on, technology was a fax machine and the manager smoking a cigarette with the feet up on the desk. And that's what, and hey, sign that paper, fill out that paper guest card for me. And
yellow copy goes to procurement, goes to invoicing, right?
And attribution was done by whoever brought you, like, and I started my industry at the Apartment Guide in DC. So, and we ruled the world from a print advertising standpoint. And I'd visit every property every month and give the love and, you know, and be an ear. And I'm not sure I was really solving problems then, quite honestly, but I was definitely being an ear. And that is solving a problem because, you know, managers and maintenance people on site are often overlooked, unfortunately, when you get higher up in the industry. And that's where the magic happens, right? And they just want an ear sometimes. So attribution was them liking you. And when you fax them every single month. You know, it's funny. We talk about TRS and Office Space. If you know Office Space.
Yeah. Well, we're the same age. So we could go on for hours about.
We actually had at the Apartment Guide in 2000, a TRS, a traffic rental survey. And you know what the science of it was? You faxed a form to the manager every single month. And you said, hey, how many leases did I bring you last month? And they'd be like, oh, I love you, Joe. You brought me 10 leases last month. And that was the science of it. So that was technology back then. So very fortunate to ride that wave through my career. I left the Apartment Guide in 03. And that's when I started my career. I went to a company called CallSource, which doesn't exist anymore. We sold that company in 2012. It became LeaseHawk. Mike Mueller bought the company. For those of you who don't know Mike Mueller, he created a technology called Vaultware, which gives us all the real-time pricing that we have now across the board on all the major
PMs. Very cool.
Yeah, so Mike's a genius in the industry. You know, during the almost 10 years I was at CallSource, we had to redefine ourselves a couple of times. We started out as a technology company. We did call tracking, monitoring, things like that. Well, we commoditized that because all the ILSs were starting to be born, and all the ILSs wanted to prove that they brought traffic. This new internet thing isn't going away. It's not bad. you know, and I'll say this out loud since Apartment Guide it doesn't exist anymore really, but Apartment Guide was late to adopt. Like, you know, I'll never forget, you know, pounding a fist on the desk, and I'm not going to say his name because he's no longer with us, but he thought the internet was a fad, and we were, you know, gods back then. But, you know, Blockbuster found out that's not the way to do things, right? So,
so like I remember a flyer that would come around, and it was called Waiters en Route. And it was basically a little, you know, the kind of recycled paper thickness of just menus from restaurants that you would order, you know, order from, and they would bring you stuff, like just things like that that were like they solved the same problem that solved today, was a completely different way, right?
Yep. Exactly. You know, and you have to figure out, like, look, companies evolve, and the companies that don't evolve fail. And, you know, and that happened to CallSource. We commoditized ourselves because all the ILSs were coming and we were selling tracking on pennies on the dollar. So we realized that we were actually recording 2 million phone calls a month. Why aren't we doing call performance, right? Mm-hmm. So we became a performance management company, evolved, and then sold the company to Mike Mueller. That really gave me the first taste of scaling a company for acquisition. It's mm-hmm. I'm an athlete. I played lacrosse. I mean, that's one reason that I'm not at AIM and TAA this week. I was supposed to be there. I have had two back surgeries in the past 7 weeks. One expected, one unexpected. But and by the way, huge thank you to you and your team for working with me, considering I was supposed to be on your podcast the day before I had emergency surgery. So thank you for dealing with me on that. But you know, it's one of those things where you find out what your passions are, and you find out, you know, mm-hmm. what really drives you. And in this industry, it's always the people. You know, at least I feel it is, and I feel we've gotten away from that. Like, look, I'm an embracer of technologies and efficiencies. And as I've learned to grow companies and scale companies, either for acquisition or just, you know, stabilization, I've learned to really embrace the ones that are solving a problem that is easy to position. And it may be something that people don't realize is broken, or it may be something that everyone realizes is broken, and there's 20 products around it that are doing it, but not the right way, you know. And you know, and when we talk about Gatewise and we talk about my portfolio of companies, you know, I'm very honest, and I know the CEO of Gatewise is okay with this, but you know, I have 9 companies in my ownership portfolio. When I started my own company 4 years ago, I think I was just to the point of I've built several companies. I've exited several successfully. I've exited a few unsuccessfully. And I also still own equity in companies that I built and have decided to stabilize through time. You know, Gatewise is a good success story, and it really made me realize what I want to value in the rest of my career. I mean, like it or not, I'll be 50 years old this year. I'm one of the old fogies in the space, right? You know, I let the young guys, you know, have the glory and get out there, like Mike Wolburn, Zach Sloan, and all those guys. And you got Tony Sousa out there hitting the market hard. Like, I love that, because they also want to create a little bit of stuff we're not allowed to, like controversy, because part of what I have been pushing against the past several years is I want to talk about the things people don't want to talk about, because that's the only thing that's going to change our industry. Because I hate to tell you, I've been around since 99 and it's 2025 and we're still talking about the same problems we did in 1999. And we have all this oversaturation of technology. So we need to break through some of that. And I want you to comment. You were at AIM and I feel I'm really bummed, because I know AIM was very, you know, pivotal this year when we're talking about where the industry's going. And not only that, but how do you get through the noise of it all? You know, I'm fortunate. I'm on both sides of the fence. I'm on the supplier side. I've been my whole career. I've chosen to do that, but I'm very fortunate. I'm also on the operator side right now. I'm actually the owner's agent for about 300,000 units that I'm making buying decisions for when it comes to, you know, ancillary type opportunities and revenue generating opportunities. And it's interesting how that tide has changed. And, you know, Gatewise is one of the companies and, you know, that I've worked with, in full transparency, they were a client for 2 years, you know, and I refused to come and work in the day to day, because that's kind of where I'm trying to get away from. I want to work with several companies and help them, whether they're startups or whether they have a great idea and a lot of money, but have no idea about our industry and need to navigate through strategic ideas. So, Gatewise is one of those companies, right? Bootstrap company. And I realized quickly that I only really want to work with bootstrap companies now.
Yeah. Know? Well, that makes a big difference, right? You operate differently.
Great. I mean, I was a part of helping build the multifamily vertical at Zillow. You know, they work as a startup, even though back then they were, you know, $6 billion international company. There's a lot of red tape, right? And usually if it's a VC-backed company, there's a board and things like that. Bootstrap companies are fun because they're nimble and you can make decisions that better suit fixing the solutions for your clients than...
Oh, I totally agree. Like, I think the constraint of focus, the constraint of bootstrapping forces the focus. And I, that's certainly something, a lesson that I think I've learned and everyone else learned over, you know, the last 3-4 years, is that the abundance of capital doesn't necessarily scale. It forces you to put more trips in more places when that's not the goal, right? You're supposed to be putting your chips in one spot, but it's just difficult. But yeah, it's revenue makes you do funny things, and capital makes you do funny things. And I think that there's certainly it might appear to be romantic at the bootstrap level, but it really forces focus, and that focus can create big things because you do the right things in the right order versus trying to kind of like do it backwards, or you know, arrive at a milestone by hacking your way through it. I don't think that's available anymore. I just don't think it's a possibility.
It's tough. And look, I prefer it. I acquired a new company exactly 4 weeks ago yesterday. Nice. I'm trying to stay out of the day to day, but you know how it is in those certain circumstances. You're looking for efficiencies. You're looking, you know, where like, okay, why are we spending money on an office? Like it's, you know, and nobody goes to it, you know? So there's a lot of things that you have to create to really make sure you build that stability. And you have a lot more capability to do that when you don't have people that you raise money from over your shoulder saying, I don't want you to do it that way. I want you to do it this way. And look, I'm very fortunate that I've never been scared to take risks in my entire career. I've always, I'm also not fortunate, and I learned something a little late, like 10 years ago. I was 40. You know, I have two boys, one's in college, one's in high school. They're 19 and 16. And at the time, they were 10 and 7. And I was living on a plane 5 days a week, running around the country. And then one day I woke up in a city. I couldn't remember where I was on a Friday. And I'm like, all right, I can't do this anymore. And that day I realized, and I was working for a huge company that we've already talked about, making all the money in the world, and I could still be there probably, who knows. But I realized quickly that, and my friends have heard me say this, that was the day I realized that, you know, money is not the most valuable asset on our planet, and it's not diminished.
Yeah. Yeah.
Time.
Look at your back, man. You're back from, like, you know, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, right? I get that. Yeah. I get that.
Time. Like for me, time has become the most valuable asset because it's a diminishing asset, right? And it's one that I think all of us don't value. And quite honestly, part of the exercise I'm going through right now with the new company I acquire is I'm doing a whole margin analysis because, like, they never incorporated their time into their pricing. And I'm like, that's a mistake. You know what I mean? Like your time is the most valuable thing that I can get from you. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and we can go down those holes for a while, but you know, I don't, you know, we talked about this in the beginning. Like I don't look at sales as, now, by the way, I do have a psych degree. And when I got my psych degree in, the 90s, all my friends made fun of me while they were getting their other degrees, you know, a couple in marketing and a couple other areas. And, you know, now I'm discovering I probably got the most valuable degree of any of them because I use my degree.
Oh, yeah.
People industry. I'm married. I have kids. I use it every second of every day. And, you know, part of what I do is, you know, I tell every salesperson that either works for me or I mentor or advise or whatever, like, don't ever go into a situation selling. Go into a situation truly knowing that you have the right solution to the problems they're going to tell you about, because if you tell them their problems, it doesn't resonate as much. Now, you can tell them their problems when you develop that relationship, but you don't get on the phone and say, here's your problem. You let them tell you.
Even if you know the problems, exactly. You have to have them articulated because there's something that's triggered psychology. that when it comes out of your mouth, it prints in twice, right? And then it comes out of your mouth in their language. Like I could tell somebody, you got to do it this way. And if they say it, I do it that way. And then that's the way. And that's the problem that we're solving. It's not how I articulate it. My language is just a distraction, right? To how they, so it's just one more piece of work that they've got to think about and translate. Because if I say, I don't know, work orders, if I say something that's like, it's just basically not their language, it doesn't really matter, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's the thing that definitely have to have those conversations. The psychology one's interesting because like, I do find that, here's my example. So I've got my oldest is a junior in college, and I chat about what he's going through right now quite a bit. Cause like I get to kind of revisit my career a little bit, and I'm pushing him to get into sales. You know, he's going to graduate with an accounting degree, but I'm like, dude, I think that like I would rather you learn sales at a younger age than having to learn it when you're 45, 50. Right. Mm-hmm. Cause you ultimately have to learn sales. It's just, you know, him or me or you, you're ultimately going to, if you want to achieve your ambitions, you're going to have to find out other people's goals and figure out how you match with them. Cause just, you know, holding your breath and pouting over what you want to achieve is not going to get you anywhere. And so that in marriage and partnerships and whatever, that discovery, like that's something that is, it just makes it so much easier. Like we celebrate the Elon Musk's or the, A16Z's, you know, the Ben Hart, whatever, these guys, right? Who are Mark Andreessen, who are like totalitarians, but it's not how it actually works. Like it's not how success comes from. Those might be the Bill Gates's, those might be the one-offs, but they're not actually the rule. And so it's trying to figure out, especially multifamily. So actually, I got a good segue here. So you brought up something about talking about what people don't want to talk about. And so I have an interesting kind of discovery question, given the portfolio scope that you guys have. And this is, it feels like the owner and the manager relationship is unique in that you've got one that is the owner of the capital asset, and then one is the steward of the capital asset. But the steward of the capital asset, you know, gets revenue from all sorts of different sources. And so what I've been, you know, at AIM, this is kind of a bit of a heated conversation. I'm curious to get your take if you're willing. Is that there's a contention that in order to sell, if you sell something that benefits the owner, you have to make it pay for the managers, or you have to figure out a rebate model or a kickback model, because they need to make their money too. And so I don't know, what have you, without naming names or whatever, what do you feel about that statement that there's got to be, like, given that the owner is the, you know, owns the NOI and the manager maybe creates the NOI, but they've got to get paid for that and fairly commensurated for it. Like, I don't think it's unfair to make money, but I find it's a bit shady to make it on the back end of the things, of everything, you know?
I'm going to
feel weird.
I don't normally answer things carefully, but I know like there's a lot of things that go on behind the curtains, whether it's a national fee manager, whether it's a local fee manager, like, honestly, the fee model has changed so dramatic. I mean, I know it doesn't seem like it, but the fee model has changed dramatically. I mean, I've seen more owners take management in-house and then bring back out of house. And, you know, there's a lot of different areas. You know, Graystar changed the world. You know, they have a portfolio so large that they can charge sub-2 on deals and make it up on volume, you know, and that's hard to live by. And I think the problem is, I think that other fee managers are trying to compete on price, and I'm not sure they should compete on price. Now, I think they should compete on what they're offering. And I'm trying to tiptoe a teeny. It's not normally like me because I know some fee managers are stuck in certain things that they have to perform. Well,
they've got economics. Like the challenge that I see is it's actually, I've got no problem with a fair value exchange, none whatsoever. I think that's if you don't have that, you don't have business. And ultimately these, you know, you got a fee manager who's managing $100 million building, like they should get paid for that. If you're a wealth manager, you're managing $100 million asset portfolio, you know, of equities, you get paid on that. So it's like, I don't see it. I have no problem with that at all. I just feel it's like, there's, as a supplier, if there's pressure to kind of back end stuff that makes money for the manager, it feels unnatural. I'll put it that way. I mean, if all three, those are the rules, those are the rules.
But I agree.
It feels unnatural.
Well, especially, you know, right now we're in an environment that if you sell couches to a property, they're looking in the couch cushion to see if there's any change in them. Like, seriously. And I mean, it's that, true. Right? Like, we're looking for every penny, every dollar. And right now, if you don't have a service that either makes the property money or saves the property money, proven, it's kind of a hard, you know,
but that's
a
the thing that's, sell that's, right now. But that's the rub, is you can put together an NOI boost or ROI capture. But if the person managing the operation doesn't get a slice of that, work. It doesn't work for the manager. And so then you fail in implementation. Yeah. And so that's the part that I'm just exploring.
And there's so many. Okay. First of all, we can have a whole podcast just about this subject. Yeah. So we're going to have to decide when we want to stop talking about this subject. So we're going to be on till 6 o'clock. So but there's so many ways to look at this and dissect it and really, you know, every company's different. I will tell you the way I've handled it in the past. You know, I've seen everything. I've seen fee managers call it admin fees. I've seen fee managers call it, you know, right. In the past, what I've done to reduce friction is I will get a master agreement with both the owner and the management company, and they will both.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
interesting.
And that doesn't work in every situation, obviously, but there's definitely situations where you have to do it that way, especially nowadays. I mean, asset managers are more involved, I feel, than they've ever been the past 2 years. You know what I mean? And they're turning over rocks. And if you're not accounting for revenue you're making off their asset and they don't know about it, it can be interesting. But some of these
it can be a very uncomfortable conversation, right?
Exactly. Well, and worse, I mean, look, if you are sub two or two on your fees for managing the deal, you almost feel like you have to go out and find stuff to make sure you can pay to run the asset. You know what I mean? So it's a tough situation.
I'll give you this one. It's the old Columbia House Records, right? Like, you're a penny for 10 CDs, but you got to buy 10 more at like whatever, 35, 30 bucks, whatever price was. But it's like, you know, everyone's got to make money somehow.
Yep. Hey, Gabriel, so funny. I just talked this past weekend because I had the sickest CD collection ever. And I refused to get rid of them because I would fall for that every time. In college, I'll never forget it. They gave me a Discover card and I will not allow my college kid has a credit card that I have given him and I can look at. He is not allowed to. I'm not kidding. He's gotten no less than 30 or 40 credit card applications in the past year. He's a freshman. He's a rising sophomore in college.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget it. I maxed my Discover card out in under a month because I spent it all on CDs and things like that. Yeah, yeah. Right. So, but my point of all that is too, is like, okay, that's great. How do we make money? And I get it.
Yeah.
Like, but Graystar is in a place where they have that clout that, and I hate to call them out specifically, but they've kind of mastered it, right? They have the clout to say, okay, we need best in brand pricing. And we need best in brand revenue share or however else that we want to do this.
That's fair. Like, I think that's the part that I'm kind of like, I've an initial blush. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right. Cause well, this is the talk at the conference, is that there's a lot of it's back-ended. I felt if it was just like transparent, and that wouldn't be back-ended. Like, you know, you make money on a vendor, no problem. That's a management fee. You make money on a part, no problem. That's a markup fee. That happens in life all the time. Why do we get it back ended so that it's not transparent to the owner? That's a part that I'm still learning about and how it actually works. Cause if that's just the business, then that's okay. But you don't want to be caught with your pants down. Right. And that's the thing that I'm just figuring out. And so it was an interesting conversation because, like, basically if you can't, you know, I was talking to somebody else, like, you know, an executive at another software company, is like, well, if you don't make money for the managers, you're not going to make money. And I was like, man, I got to figure this out. This is a puzzle that I've been kind of wrestling with over the last few months.
Take that one step further. If you're not involving them, like, I have plenty of times I've seen people go to owners and they have to roll stuff out to the fee managers and it's a fight the entire way. And or vice versa. You go to a corporate decision maker and you have stuff rolled down to the property and the properties and the regionals. Look, we all know the regional layer is the layer of our industry that everything happens, good or bad.
Yep.
And If you're not keeping that layer informed, you got a problem.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you'll have errors. For sure. That's like the old, I liken that to the old World War II movies where you've got kind of like a bunch of people standing around a world map, just moving armies around with big, huge shuffleboard things. Cause it's like, they have no context of actually what's happening on the ground. They're just moving bodies around. Right. It doesn't make any sense.
That's a good analogy. So, almost,
actually. You got it. I mean, and that's for a certain generation would only appreciate that.
True.
Living left with Indiana Jones. But like, you know, I just try to think through that in terms of like, okay, and really it's about stakeholder management. Like you've got to consider the implementation branch and the ownership branch. And so like, I've actually had conversations that are emerging as quite healthy, where it's like, I talk to the fee manager goes, okay, this sounds like a great idea. We should do it. Now, not everyone's going to buy in. I need you to go sell these lists of five owners are likely to consider this as an alternative. And go sell those five. And then when they buy in, then bring it back to us and we'll have a deal. And so, okay, that seems like a fair game. And I don't feel like I'm being put on a goose chase in that one. I feel like there's transparency in terms of, that's Graystar. Like they were very transparent around how they buy. And I was super impressed because it could have been, like we got a couple of big customers in outside of this business. And it's a long drawn out process. But like these guys are, I was super impressed. You know, and everyone calls them Death Star and all these different things, but I'm like, my engagements with them has been very, very transparent, and it's the least I could ask for. And maybe because they're the big giant gorilla in the cage, but I tell you something, I was very impressed, and I was kind of expecting the worst, but it was
something to be said for that, though. You know, like in their investment, like Gardner, Jessica, that whole team, that whole national team has expanded a lot in the way they do things, and they do it. Here's the thing. Some people may call it Death Star or whatever, but they have a precise way they do it, and they're very and they lay it out, you know. And sure, you know, to be an approved provider, you have to jump through some certain hoops. But guess what? They also want to make sure that they're vetting out the people that they're putting as approved advisor. So, approved provider. Now, anybody that's been in our industry knows that if you get any kind of agreement with the NMHC top 10 and dare I say even top 25, it's a license to hunt. It's not guaranteeing you a thing. You got work to do still. You just have to be strategic in how you do that work.
Well, and I think the interesting side of it all is that with that kind of, I would probably venture to guess, and I don't know this for truth, but I would just venture to guess that they might have more compliance obligations than anybody else in the whole business because they're the biggest. And so consequently, like if from a liability perspective, let's say there's any sort of wrongdoing, right? And that they'll be in the news. Like if you're a liability lawyer, they go right at that one, right? And so I'm respectful of the fact that they held themselves to a higher standard, and we don't have a deal, right? But they're just at first impressions, they're like, this is how we buy, this is how it goes, this is how it might take a year. It wasn't like the whole hot and cold experience. They're just like, keep us involved. I loved it.
Perfect. And they communicate.
Now I know how to manage this.
They communicate. So here's my biggest thing. Transparency and communication will solve almost anything and accountability, right? Like you got to have accountability too. But like all I ask for in life is don't ghost. Like, and by the way, you have a kid, a couple of years older than my oldest, but that's my 19-year-old biggest issue is he doesn't understand that. Like, hey, you have to answer people when, like, especially if I'm paying your cell phone bill, I expect a response. Like, you know, not that, but I want people to understand the steps. Like, in my opinion, it's a cheat code, right? If you're working with, and it's a true partnership. Like, the word partner is, I love the word and I hate it at the same time, because if you do it right and you actually, partnership means that is equal on both sides, the pain and the reward, right? A partnership is not one-sided pain and reward and one person trying to push things. That's not a partnership. And I'm very honest when I'm talking to these companies too and say, look, we look at a true partnership, and the more that you give, the more we can give. And it's really symbiotic of each other, right? So that's how we try. But you also know our industry. Sometimes you have to do stuff that follows the way things need to be done with that company. And like you were saying, I'm okay with that too, as long as you know what those steps look like.
That's right. That's right. And that's the part that I'm learning about. Because even as I come into the initial pitch, I have to consider the value proposition that affects the P&L of the management company, right? Because they're going to be a gatekeeper on adoption no matter what. And so if I can align interests, I just need to consider how to align interests so it benefits them as well, versus just, because this is where the classic ROI conversation falls apart. Is that if I put together an ROI conversation that works just for the owner, but not for the manager, it's not going to work. And so it's that consideration of both stakeholders, right?
Right. And this is overlooked all the time. I know I'm stating the obvious, but a lot of people forget that a property is a multi-million dollar asset. So every property manager is a CEO of a multi-million dollar asset. And we never, like, not never. My wife is on me about talking in extremes. I've been working on it for several months. Don't say never. Don't say always. All that stuff. But for the most part, companies don't look at the property manager as a CEO of that asset. And at the end of the day, they're at least influential up the chain. And for me, like, and anybody that's ever worked with me would tell you, I don't care what size company you are, you're going to get the same treatment if you're an owner managed five property owner as you are Graystar, because I still respect the fact that you have multiple multi-million dollar assets that you have to manage to performance, you know, whether they're yours or someone else's. You know what I mean?
Well, so this is what I'm saying. Like, you talk about like asset management as a discipline, like it's not considered that way, right? Like, even like if you go at, you know, everyone's all, we spent a whole day at AIM, one day was felt this way. It felt like a whole day was committed to just the renewal conversation, right? And everyone's wringing their hands about renewals, which is rightfully so. But you think about it, especially given your background and your multiple portfolios, like it's a recurring revenue business. Like acquisition has to be, like retention should be 3x greater than acquisition costs, but not in this industry, right? It's like 1-to-1. Like if you got 50% turnover of your revenue base, like, okay, some of it's going because of life changes, but some of it's going because you're running a bad business. But there's just, you know, it's okay to have 50% turnover, which doesn't make any sense at all, right? And so like if the acquisition costs were aligned with if there's an LTV to, or a CAC to LTV kind of conversation, then that would actually look different than how these are valued. And when you think about it, where it falls apart, is you take the NOI and then a cap rate, like that is taking a LTV or CAC to LTV or cost acquisition to long lifetime customer value perspective on the asset. And when you've got lumpy revenue, or let's say at risk revenue, because you've got such a high turnover on your unit revenue, then that number just can't be, like it just can't be divided by five, right? Or times five, get that cap rate. So it's an interesting kind of revelation that I'm trying to work through right now with respect to how do I make this work for everybody?
Do you know what turnover rates were in 1999?
No, I don't.
50-53%. You know what turnover rates are in 2025?
Same thing. They're the same thing.
So we have to ask ourselves, like, and I say this a lot, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but unfortunately this industry is the definition of insanity, right? Like a lot of times, you know, we're doing the same thing over and over again, expecting something different. And, you know, there's more technology than there's ever been in our space, but there's also a lot of static noise. So it's the opposite of the problem we had 5-7 years ago, and or maybe longer. I don't know, COVID kind of screwed up my time perception, but, you know, we'll call it 5-10 years ago, where we always got a knock about being, you know, 5-7 years behind every other industry, mostly hospitality. I think we've closed that gap, but we've created the opposite problem. We have an oversaturation of technologies. I have so many client owner friends that call me and they're like, hey, all I want is X product and there's 20 companies that do it. Can you tell me the top 2 or 3?
So yeah, it's interesting. That exact conversation, I was talking with 2 vendors just this morning and we're like, you know what? Like it's hard to buy. And we were all in the same maintenance space. And I said, like, okay, we do this part really well. And I don't want anything to do with the part that you do. That is just like a bailiwick of work that confuses our developers, confuses our roadmap, confuses the message of the market. Nothing to do with that. But the market would think that we compete. You know, how can we help them realize that we don't compete?
Right.
You know, like, how can we help them realize that we would actually be better off integrating with you as a partner, right? We could create a better experience for what you do versus, you know, like have this perception that we compete together. So it's, you know, as vendors, we do have to start staking I don't know, it sounds overly collaborative for people that are competing for the same, in this case, maintenance dollar. But it's at the same time, it's like, we got to help these people make decisions because it's confusing as a vendor perspective for us to put ourselves all in the same bucket. And, you know, we might do this really well, but we could do all of this as well.
Yeah. Look, I'm an old new school, right? Like, even when I coach people on sell, like, that's another problem. We could spend another hour on this too, but technology have made younger salespeople lazy. And I'm just going to flat out say it. They're relying on technology too much. They're relying on email campaigning too much. And there's none of that personal, like we talked about earlier, you know, consultative approach to things. And I'm not going to dive back into that, but, you know, at the end of the day though, I think on the supply, and we've tried this a few times, you know, and suppliers just have to look, I don't say vendors out loud, even though I'm also a partner in a procurement business and that we say vendor all the time, but I've always hated it because I'm not schlepping hot dogs, but I'm embracing it, I guess.
Vendor.
I think the only way that we're really going to be able to change that perception is to do it ourselves. And, you know, I actually personally embrace every competitor I've ever had in my, as a matter of fact, some of my best friends are people that have been competitors in my career because we're in the biggest freaking industry, like on the planet. There's so much room for everybody. And if you're this piece and another company's this piece and another company's this piece, and you're all three being compared as competitors, okay. How do we change that perception? You change that perception by actually promoting the fact that, you know, that you work seamlessly together through processes that you address. And I'll bring this into a real life example, like Gatewise. You know, Gatewise, obviously by the name, was founded, you know, the CEO of Gatewise is an old coder and developer. And he saw a problem. And the problem he saw is he saw gates open all over the place. So he just started, he built our very first module. And he started knocking on the apartment community doors. I'm kind of being a little dramatic with the knocking, of course, but, and he said, hey, is your gate broken? I've noticed it's been open. They're like, no, it hasn't worked in a year. He goes, if I can fix it for you for free, will you let me do that? And they said, absolutely. And that's how we started. He literally was going around and sticking our modules that he created. You know, that's another beautiful thing. We have our own OEM software and hardware. So we never had any issues or supply chain issues and stuff. So he was able to grow the business organically that way. And then we've gone from there. But even now, we specialize in everything front of community to the resident door. We do not have smart tech. And we do have unit locks that are launching later this year, but they don't need Wi-Fi. They're on Alga code. And
I heard that from Joseph. It sounds awesome. Like cellular based, great. Like you just pop it on.
And it's like $2 a unit versus like $5 to $7. And it's very cost effective. His vision was always make it affordable for the B and C communities that have never had the access to products like this. And because he took that approach, we now are launching products like a virtual call box that goes with any access point, which means, and we're selling it for free. So you don't need expensive call boxes and things like that. Everybody's cell phone is their call box. And we're able to get more ingrained in a community and solve problems of, you know, access to certain areas and stuff. But as of right now, and I hope never in the future, we have zero desire to go past that resident door. Unit locks is like kind of the last step. But there's tons of companies, Smart Rent, iApartments, Breve. I can keep naming companies that have internal unit, smart units. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
If a client wants it, and we're very honest about this, we will refer, and we have partnership agreements with some of those companies, iApartments specifically, because we know we can't satisfy that for the client, and they don't satisfy what we do. We're the best in breed at one thing. They're the best in breed at other. If we marry the two together, it's the best for the client. And I think that as suppliers, vendors, whatever, we have to start doing that more.
Do you find like, so when you bring up you brought up a great concept, like, so like Gatewise, so example, you know, the no call box. When you have to go and explain that to somebody the first time, they kind of look at you sideways and go, but what about the callbacks? Callbox. You go, well, there's no call box. And they go, but what about the call box? And you go, kind of, no, but there's no call box. And they go, but the call box is here. And they hit 1102 and they get to talk to somebody. You go, but there is no call box. And they're like, is there a bit of a short, you almost like they almost short out? You have that conversation?
A little bit. But here's what's interesting. We actually explain it by doing. You know what I mean? Like we make sure, like My guys are at TA right now. Walk up right up to the booth and they'll give you a self-guided tour demo just because they can do it with you right there on their phone and be around the corner and can walk in and say, I'm here for my appointment. And so they can walk you through it live. We made it so that we can show it and they can touch it and they can feel it and they're part of it. And like whenever we're doing self-guided tour demos right now is we're look, the self-guided tour, we only went into self-guided tours because clients asked us to. It's kind of a natural progression. Hey, you're doing all of our access control. Like, we want to look at self-guided tours, but it only makes sense for you to do it. So we built one and it's great. It's effective. And to be quite honest for you, we're not looking at it as a revenue generator. We're looking at it as a value add for our clients. It's very inexpensive. Sure. And our clients that use us for access control on a big scale get it for free. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so we did in our virtual call box, that's a big problem our industry has had since the beginning of time. You could put a virtual call box on any entryway, on the gate, anywhere you on any gatewise access point, and it doesn't cost you a penny, but it makes communication easier with prospects, guests coming in to see visitors, you know, or visitors coming in to see residents and things like that. So, you know, but you're right. You got to show it. You can't just talk about it because it's hard for people. What do you mean I don't have to push a button? Or what do you mean there's no video screen? Well, there is a video screen. It's your phone. You know, so if we have to talk about it and can't just show it like in person and involve them, you know, in it themselves, I generally compare it to like a FaceTime that has actionable stuff that routes off of it. But I think times will change, but you know how our industry is. It's so used to certain things that it's hard to change that perception. And once you're in the multifamily box, it's even harder to think outside of it sometimes.
Like one of the things we've been working on is like, how can we make this seem as close to what you do right now as exactly as possible? Like, so you do this exactly the same way and you just this little bit different, and then you do this exactly the same way, but better, downstream. Right. And that's how, you know, that's where we're trying to position things. And then even just at the AIM conference, as you're closing out, we were in that startup pitch. And you know, 20 years ago at AIM, like 2005, they launched video virtual tours, right? Video podcast or podcast tours or something like that. And like, you know, so we kind of made the metaphor that you've been using video to sell apartments for 20 years now. Well, why don't you using video to serve apartments, right? The next 20 years, right? It's maintenance term, right? You obviously agreed that it's the form doesn't really do the physical space justice. Like the built world doesn't look good enough, work good enough form, and decided that 20 years ago. So let's just make this easier on the maintenance side of things. And like, and I hope that landed, but I think you still got people looking back at me going, I don't get it. I'm like, just trying to keep figuring out how do you land on their language, on their page, on their problem, on their pain and their priority so that they can kind of go, I get it. And, you know, we do a lot of showing and telling for sure. That's every part of every single demo. And that's part of the, once you can see it, you can't unsee it, but it still doesn't get everybody.
Yep. And I also think we have problems because we force clients to move faster than they're comfortable moving. And they don't say that to us. You know what I mean? Like sometimes a company is doing something this way and they need to do it this totally different way, but you can't just go-karts to NASCAR. You gotta work their way, crawl, walk, run. So, and we're going through that, you know, in several areas with clients. And look, we actually at the end of last year decided, because a lot of our clients own commercial real estate, but also sell storage facilities. So like I've been around for a long time. Like, I'll just say it that, and like, I did not realize how many multifamily real estate companies own self-storage facilities, but it makes perfect sense if you think about it. Like, it's just people's stuff living in there. Their unit economics are different, but their problems are the same. They have turnover, they have vacancy, you know, they have all the things. They run concessions, but guess what else they have? A lot of archaic access control. So we saw an opportunity to really go in there and come up with some innovative solutions on the self-storage side. And, you know, when we talk about, I know we joked in the beginning about how the old days multifamily was viewed as being 5 to 7 years around hospitality and other innovation. Yeah. Well, self-storage is legit 7 to 10 years behind multifamily. Well,
I got one for you to dig up that I was shocked. It kept coming up all again. I was doing a bunch of research on DTRSFR, publicly traded companies, right? And RV kept coming up. Like, I don't even have a pitch on RV. But RV, same story, right? They might even be more compelling for you guys.
I own an RV. I'm very familiar. So yeah, it's
the
same.
But you know, the amount of volume of RV rentals was just shocking for me. And you know, you start peeling the onion on this whole industry of property management and rentals. It's just like, man, that's crazy. And I often make the joke that like property management is the second oldest industry in the world, right, next to the first, because like there was somebody that needed a house to do the oldest, you know, industry in the world. And like, you know, I often make the joke that like landlords were the original villain, like they literally threw Jesus out, right? So like, and that story has been told 100 times over and over again. And so you kind of go like, there's a reason why they kind of have a bad perception that needs to be some shining. Yeah. It's, and then you throw on everything else on top of it. But that's what makes it fun, right? I mean, I think of the industry, like what I've been really excited about this conversation in this industry is that there's plenty of people that are willing to help. There's lots of opportunity out there. There's lots of inefficiency. There's lots of places to make money. And I think what's really exciting right now, more than ever, is that they've got to change the way they did things before. So, which brings a kind of a common question we talk about always is like, you know, given your portfolio and, you know, in your history, like when you talk about like a time wall or compelling event, like how do you test for that? How do you listen for, I've got to do this by then? The urgency conversation in sales.
All right. Clarify which part of that. Do you mean having the client realize that or just anything in particular and how you drive something?
Like, I mean, like it kind of goes the same. Like just because I've got a quarter in doesn't mean you've got a quarter in from a customer perspective, right? So we've got to create, you either can create urgency, but I'm coming around to the conversation that we need to capture urgency versus create urgency. So it's, I mean, to create value propositions and ROIs, et cetera, no problem. But then the urgency piece has to, this is part of the hell yes side. The urgency piece has to come to us. We can't naturally create it. And so like given the, you know, the different backgrounds, the different portfolios you've had, how did you manage to capture that urgency, if that word works, versus trying to create urgency with a prospect?
Thank you for clarifying. And I love that distinction. I'm going to steal that one from you too. So there's two things I'm stealing from you today. I think it's a great question, and it really does depend on what you're selling and what the budgetary constraints look like on what you're selling. Sure. I'll use Gatewise first. You know, Gatewise has a CapEx and an OpEx perspective to it. So just for your audience, in case they don't know, capital expenditure means big upfront costs. You know, you're getting the roof done, you're getting your parking lot paved, whatever. OpEx is recurring expenses. The REITs hate all. If anybody out there is working with REITs, eliminate as much of your OpEx as you can, and you'll have a lot more success with REITs. But a lot of companies don't like the OpEx because it multiplies when it's on an NOI, that expense. So just to kind of give a quick breakdown there. But Gatewise is interesting because it taps both of those perspectives. We're in a position because we are bootstrapped. We do control our own supply chain. We do also have our own installation company outside of Texas. We do have preferred partners and stuff, but we haven't agreed upon. Our rates nationally are the same for install everywhere, whether you're in Seattle, Washington, or Omaha, Nebraska. We don't give an upcharge for that just because of where they are. So,
and it's part of the product design, as I understand it, is that it's easy to install, right?
Oh, it is so easy. Typically, it's like three wired. The magic's what's in there, our technology. I mean, the SaaS is the magic too. Yeah. We also have the flexibility and the capital buildup that we can actually customize deals. Oh, you don't want a heavy CapEx? Okay. We can amortize that into OpEx for you, or you hate OpEx. Great. We can reduce your OpEx by building it. So we could certainly be flexible in that way, which makes it easier for us. And don't forget, Gatewise is a product that, yes, people come to us proactively, but generally it's reactively because, you know, a lot of people, when they ask who our competitors are, I'm like, honestly, we don't really like, they're like, oh, SmartRent must be. I'm like, no, not really. I mean, our real competitors are Door King and Linear, which are old archaic solutions that we're generally ripping and replacing on a continual basis at apartment communities because we're reliable. And not just that, a lot of their old equipment is outdated and you have to literally replace all systems. So our point of entry with Gatewise is a little bit different. We try and capture urgency, which I'm going to start saying,
I'm gonna think about. I'm gonna write about that. I gotta think about that. That came out. That just came out.
It's beautiful. I love it, and it does kind of, it does kind of capture what we're trying to say here, and the fact that it, look, multifamily is maddening because you can literally get one phone call and that night have the agreement. Yep. Or it could take you 3 years to get one deal. And if anybody tells me they know the sales cycle of multifamily, they're crazy, because it's very segmented in how it is. But at the end of the day, you have to find out, it's not just about finding out their pain points. You have to find out what drives them fiscally and how they do business. What does their COO and CFO, how are they looking at it? How are they running their business? Are they owner managed? Are they fee managed? Like, there's so many factors that go in to how we capture that urgency, right? Mm-hmm. Because an owner, it's a lot easier to capture urgency with an owner, especially if it's a big issue. You capture urgency with a fee manager a lot faster if residents can't get in a building or something like that, and you're the hero coming to fix it. In SaaS related technology type services or marketing services, you know, I think you capture urgency by telling a story. You know what I mean? It's hard, and to push enough in the within the parameters that you know that company operates in. I'm not a pushy I don't even say salesperson, but I'm not a pushy salesperson. My people that work for me are not pushy salespeople. Oop. You know, are you there? Did I lose you? Uh-oh. Guillermo, I think you're having bandwidth issues at the conference. Are you there, bud?
I'm there. I'm back. Yeah.
There you are. There we go. You got a lot of public Wi-Fi at a conference.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm pretty good, though. Yeah. There you go. We got pretty good.
Great. That was the first time. That was good. But anyways, capturing that urgency is kind of like the unicorn situation, right? And I think you really have to understand what makes that client tick, but also the individuals you're dealing with. And one way I capture the urgency is I find out who the true decision makers are. There's too much time wasted on both sides of the fence. And you can ask politely and professionally by saying, look, Guillermo, I know you juggle 100 balls a day, but you're in charge of gathering all the information for this project. What other decision makers are involved so I can make your life easier? And that's how I approach it. And that's how everybody should. Don't be scared to ask questions. If you don't ask, you're never going to know the answer. So,
well, I think that sometimes they actually want to have permission to answer that question.
Yeah.
Because they might be polite to take you along on a little boat tour. But at the end of the day, if you don't ask that question, they're not forced to answer it. And they're not forced to answer it, then they're going to keep taking boat tours. And that's wasting everybody's time. Like, you know, they might eye roll when you email in, hey, following up, checking in, da, da, da. But if you don't understand who the buyer is, you're not going to be articulating the value proposition ever.
Right.
Because if I know I've got to get an owner on board from a fee manager's perspective, then I know I've got to position that both ways.
Right. Well, look.
Or solve a different problem for the fee manager.
Right.
That also benefits the
which also happens, right?
It happens too, right?
If you do proper discovery and nothing drives me crazier than when I go on the phone with a rep and the first thing that happens is they start vomiting all the stuff that they can do. And guess what?
Yeah.
The person you're talking to, excuse my language, doesn't give a shit about the 20 things you just talked about. They only care about two. So find out what two of those are. Ask the right question. There's not enough question asking, quite honestly. Yeah. I mean, I think we've gotten away from the art form a little bit of, you know, so I tell my reps, you have a go-to 10 to 20 questions that even if you know the answer, you're asking because you're rapport building. It's the same thing we tell leasing consultants. Yeah. You know, attribution the way it is, generally, they know that, okay, this person went from apartments.com to my website and now they're coming in to see me, but you're still going to ask them how the heck they heard about you. Why are, you know, how'd you end up here today? Because it's a rapport building question. It's the same thing. So back to my people industry thing. This is a people industry. And if you really want to capture urgency, you capture the essence of how that person and that company operates. But I will tell you this, if you get the solid answer, I want you to call me because we're going to start a company together and make sure that we're cooking up that solid answer.
Well, this is part of the whole point of the podcast, right? It's like, what does getting the hell you feel like in this business? Because, you know, it started out with like what seems to be an obvious answer became very unobvious the more I learned about it. The more deals that kind of went up the side of the pipeline, I was like, how is this like?
And remove barriers. Like, yeah, that's another thing. Remove barriers. Like, I'll get a contract. Even me, like, look, I don't even, my poor client friends, like, and a lot of them, not a lot, a bunch have been on your show. And, you know, and I know if you were listening now, and, you know, I'll just tell you, like, it's it's overwhelming the number of reach outs that we get. Like even me, I get no less than 25 texts, LinkedIn, emails every day. And my operator friends are getting more, especially around conference season, they're getting hundreds. Yeah. And that's, I have vendor friends that come to me like, hey, how do I stand out? I'm like, send me what you sent. And I laughed and I said, I'm going to be honest with you. You asked my opinion. I wouldn't reply to this. I get 25 of these a day and I reply to 1 out of 100. And you know, the ones I reply to either resonate with something that has been on my mind lately as something that a client's struggling with or something I struggle with in my own life, or they did something unique to grab my attention enough for me to learn about what they do something different. Like when video first came out, I actually loved it because the first few I got had my name on a whiteboard and it was all customized. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, you know what? Unique. I'm going to talk to that dude, even though I'm never going to buy from him. You know what I mean? And I'm honest when I say it too. And there are some cold calls that come to me. I reply just to be a little abrasive back and let them know that I wouldn't buy from them. And here's why. You know what I mean?
Because no, I'm pretty blunt. I will ask them, what's the problem you solve? Look, man, I'm quick here. What's the problem you solve? Not a priority right now. Not a priority right now. Only in a quarter. You know,
right?
And it cuts to the chase. Like it's fixed, it makes it fair. Like I think like we're at a point now. I really love this quote from Dan Sullivan. He's like a strategic coach, and he says that as a seller, you have to think in terms that you are a buyer as well.
Always,
right? Think of it as a buyer. So what are you looking for? Not what are you looking to just kind of get. And that's something that really resonates with me because I really do. I was chuckling somebody the other day. I was like, actually was on one of the forums for one of our associations. And I put like a want ad out there, not an ad, but a want ad. Here's what I'm looking for. Reminds me of like that you're a rock and roll guy, right? Wanted lead guitarist, must have badass attitude. No time wasters, please. Right. It's Paul Stanley looking for a guitarist and Chris and Kiss. And like, that's exactly what I want. Here's what I want. I want, 5,000 to 10,000 units, must be, preferably scattered site, preferably struggling with maintenance or hiring people. Preferably you have tried hiring and you've tried third party vendors and you're losing your mind. Give me a call. Like literally no time wasters, please. Garrel at, do you know what I mean? I mean, just to go through the exercise of articulating exactly what I'm looking for.
And show you care.
Must be able to make decisions. You know, yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. It's like, it's something that drives me a little nuts. And I really want a lot of coaching done with the new generation coming in. Cause I just think that, again, they're using technology instead of human nature and psychology, quite honestly, you know what I mean? It's something that we're getting away from, and there needs to be more people coaching in what we're doing.
Well, it is interesting. Like I'm onboarding onboarded her like 2 weeks ago, a new BDR. And the chance to onboard somebody new the first time, we're going through an exercise of really personalizing all of our outbound. And meaning that we're looking to write, you know, we do sequences that are job specific, region specific, company, you know, if I'm trying to sell to a certain partner that we're partnering with, a partner specific, so that language can be at scale, but still, you know, still relatively personable. To your comment earlier, like I can send the same message to 100 people, but I might just capture the ones that are looking to solve the problem. That's like the 8%, right? And so I need to figure out a way. So, you know, part of the magic that we're all figuring out right now is how can I send that outbound message without being annoying, make it relevant. But so it's not like a straight out, like, get out of my face, unsubscribe, but it's like there's a mental dismissal of not now, but there's something that I might need that later. And so then you don't get the unsubscribe, but at least you get the not now. And then eventually you'll capture them when they need to solve that problem or they have that availability to execute.
Yeah, but I 100% agree, especially in our industry. I mean, and anybody that's worked with me will tell you this, I spend a lot of my time painting pictures and analogies, reminding them that they're consumers. And take yourself out of multifamily for a minute and put yourself as a buyer of, I mean, I'm Instagram and Amazon, I help them stay in business because Instagram, I mean, that's the only social network other than LinkedIn I really get on. I'm not a big Facebooker. So Instagram's just a happy place and they know every product I ever want. It drives me nuts. But it's the same thing, right? Like, you know, you have to make sure that you're hitting them the right way. And, you know, that's part of where, and again, we could spend a whole hour on this too. LinkedIn etiquette, I think, has gotten a little out of control too. Like, when it comes to, like, I get messages like, well, obviously you haven't had time to read my message yet, but just in case you're interested in talking, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, that's really going to motivate me to get back to you. You know,
well, so that's like the old breakup email, right?
Right.
Well, obviously it's something you're trying to solve right now, which is like, it's just, it's arrogant.
It's but like, the hey, alligator hey, email was money back in the day, like 15 years ago. You remember the alligator email?
No, what's that one?
It's kind of like breakup, but you give a quick thing and then you say, well, if I'm not responding, it's because I'm not interested, or I'm just really busy, or like I was eaten by an alligator or something like that. It was, I don't know.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, just let me know.
Number 15 years ago, and I was like, this is the cheesiest thing ever. We were at Zillow at the time. We were just trying stuff. I'd have to say the appointment setting ratio from the alligator email was like 70%, maybe more. It was ridiculous.
There you go. It worked.
Anyways, I just looked and saw that it's 404, man.
Yeah,
and,
we got a rip here.
Okay,
we'll do two things. No, I'll be sorry. Two things here. So looking back at yourself, you've got the 9 portcos, your prior year, and with the context of getting to Hell Yes, right? What's a bit of advice you'd give yourself, younger self, maybe your oldest is going to be graduating soon? What would you tell them? Make sure you do this.
Never stop learning and always be humble. I don't care. You know, I say this a lot and my wife gets on me because she says, well, it's because you had that, but I don't care about titles. Like, she's like, but you've had them. I'm like, I get it, but I never cared back then either. And here's the point. I know you need structure in companies, but I believe it in a flat org, right? Like, you got to be humble and know that you started somewhere and had to ask questions or be annoying because you didn't know what you were doing. So don't take the time to make sure that you're making those better. And also the advice I give to my kids all the time is ask the question, because if you don't, the answer is always no. And
yeah.
And always be kind, professional, and respectful. Don't get me wrong. We all lose our shit sometimes, Guillermo, but at the end of the day, I'm trying to learn patience and to not sweat the small things as much. I think, but that's also an old person answering that. You know what I mean? If you would have asked me 20 years ago, I would have answered a lot differently. But I guess if I narrowed it down, it's never stop learning and don't ever think that you're perfect at what you're doing, because you're not. And secondly, as you grow in your career, don't be scared to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you and better than you, especially if it complements your weaknesses. There are too many people that purposely don't hire smart people because they feel threatened. And I think that can hold us back a lot. So that's just more human nature advice that I would say to people is never stop learning. You have so much stuff at your fingertips now. I almost hired an EA 3 months ago. And I said, forget this. I'm just going to make a commitment to really commit to ChatGPT. And it changed my life. Like,
yeah,
hours it saves me in admin work is ridiculous. Like, just, you know, creating spreadsheet, all that stuff. So find things to streamline your life and find things to really focus on what matters and not what doesn't. You know, beat through the noise. You know, I'm a big fan of OKRs. I believe in it. I juggle 150 things at a time, but I can only get 3 to 5 things done efficiently at a time, right? So I have to triage.
Yeah. What's your priority? Well, I think that for the audience, that's like at least three things to consider with respect to advice is like focus, be humble, be authentic, be respectful. You know, be mindful of the people that you're asking for their time, right? Yep. Awesome. Who should we talk to?
Who should you talk to next? I was going to say my actual motto when I said be kind is actually a lot more vulgar than that. It's don't be a D, right? Like, life is pretty simple. And I think a lot of people in this country can learn from that, right? Just, hey, it's not hard to be kind. Just don't be a jerk. It's okay.
I know. But that's a separate conversation.
I say that and then I yell at somebody for driving 10 miles an hour under the speed limit in front of me.
I know. I think that the thing is about like, well, I'm like, this is the whole thread. Like the don't be a jerk thing, I think that you can, but that doesn't mean you can't like correct people. Like like letting people continue to do things incorrectly. Like, let's just say I'm coaching somebody who's onboarding right now. She's not gonna be perfect the first time, but you've got to encourage other people to learn as well. So like, it's equally as not letting people be successful is also being a jerk. But I'll leave it.
True.
It's true. Who should we talk to next?
Now, I was laughing the first time you said it because I'm like, dude, you've already talked to like everybody. Have you had Girish on your show yet, Kahani?
No. Who's Girish Kahani? Girish, Trilogy? From Trilogy?
Yeah.
No.
Him and his brother run Trilogy Real Estate out of Chicago.
Yeah, I just met him. He was one of the panelists at AIM.
All right. Reach out to him. CC me. Look, here's why. And look, I have mentors too. We all do. Girish is my mentor, and he's younger than me. He's like 5 years old. Like, I don't even know.
He's dynamite.
I don't care about age either, but he's wise for his years.
He is. I had a chance to have a margarita with him and a bunch of his old buddies. And yeah, he was really generous with his time. That's a good call, because I do want to get more people on the operator side on, just so it's not just a prop tech show or a tech show. Like, it's
They sell too.
Salespeople. Exactly. I pitched this to Apartmentalize, and Apartmentalize turned me down because they said no one in this industry, there's no sellers here. And I was like, oh my God, you're killing me. You're killing me right now. I was like, if you're not selling, you're just doing. Like, that's just a separate thread. I'll get them back.
It drives me nuts, like, especially the stigma. You know, Tara's done a good job to break that wall down, but there shouldn't be a stigma. We're selling to operators. They're selling to consumers. We're trying to make their life easier, you know? So,
well, I'll tag him and he can, yeah, that'll be a good follow, especially since I just chatted with him yesterday. So that's fantastic. Awesome.
Perfect. He's a good one. Okay. And he's an amazing human being. So,
yeah, he's good. People get a hold of you, LinkedIn?
Yeah, please get a hold of me on LinkedIn. What is my handle at the end there? I mean, I think you're tagging me anyways, right?
Yeah, I'll tag you on the show.
It's linkedin.com in Joe Summers. You can also email me at joe@synergymfa.com or joe@gatewise.com. Either of those work. Make it intentional, please.
But I'm right on, buddy.
I will drop anything to help people, and I think anybody that knows me will tell you that. So
I really appreciate you coming on the show. This is good. Thanks for taking the journey, and especially kind of walking the fine line on that question. It just was top of mind today and yesterday around how to crack in this industry. So I appreciate your intel on that. And everyone listening on the podcast, if you listen, well, on LinkedIn Live, this will be live forever and ever. If you have any questions or comments, if you're listening to it not live, just put them in there. We'll both get to it no matter what. If you listen to the podcast on Apple or Spotify, hit like, subscribe, comment, and rate. It's always good for everybody. Thanks, Joe, for your time today. Love the inputs. And best of luck, my friend. Wish you the best of luck. All right, hang tight. That was awesome.